Good evening, friends, and welcome to Sleepy Tom Tales, a podcast aimed at helping you to get a good night's sleep. Do you find your mind plagued with the stresses of modern life, especially when the lights are out and you're trying to get a restful night? Does your spinning mind keep you awake? Follow my voice down the path towards a good night's rest. Listen to me tell a story that will keep your mind from wandering to your daytime problems. The ones you can't solve right now and will be easier to solve while rested. Listen to my voice and allow yourself to drift, following the twists and turns of the story, but slowly letting go and drifting into sleep. Before we get on with the show, I'd like to take a couple of minutes of your time. I've mentioned a couple of times recently our new partnership with Sleep Phones, and they've decided to provide Sleepy Time Tales listeners, that's you, with a great new bonus. For a limited time only, using the link I provide in the show notes and the promo code SLEEPYTIME, you will get a 10% discount on all orders over $99.95. So if you're tempted by the idea of trying out the comfort and convenience of headphones designed specifically for sleeping in, but the sticker price of a wireless pair is a bit much, or you'd like to buy a few wired sets for the family, now is the time. This offer only runs until the end of September, so please take advantage of it while it's available. I wouldn't want you folks to miss out. If you'd like to support Sleepy Time Tales a bit more directly, though, to help me going out to thousands of insomniacs just like you, please consider supporting on the Patreon. That's patreon.com/sleepytimetales. This is monthly support that not only helps me keep the lights on, but can also get you fun bonuses based on how much you contribute. From as little as $2 a month, you get early release on the main episodes, and $5 gets you weekly bonus minisodes, special edits, and a monthly megasode, which is all the month's releases in one big listen. That's the previous month's releases in one big listen. If monthly is a big ask, of course, and I understand that completely, you can make once-off tips through the tip jar on the website. Shout-out goes to long-time support and patron Chris, who threw some much-appreciated funds in the tip jar there, and also had some very kind words to say. Thanks again, as always, Chris. Your support of all types is always appreciated. On another interesting note, at least I think it's interesting, I've put a whole bunch of new merch designs up on the TeePublic store. A lot of it isn't even actually merch. It's not Sleepy Time Tales branded, but a lot of it's sort of sleep-themed sort of stuff, so it's sort of in the right vein. So if you'd like to support the podcast, but not have to explain to people exactly what Sleepy Time Tales is and why you have its logo branded all over yourself, there are options available to you there as well, and I think some of them are pretty cool. At least, I think so. I would. I've gone on a bit long, so just a quick shout out to the music as usual, which is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiko. The work is available on their website at loyaltyfreakmusic.com. Thanks for taking the time. Let's get back to the show. So what exactly is Sleepy Time Tales? What is it for? What is this strange thing, this strange idea, this podcast that you're supposed to fall asleep to? But lack of sleep is a health crisis in the 21st century, and this is a podcast intended to help those that it can to get a restful night. Do you find yourself lying awake at night, mind spinning and emotions in turmoil with anxieties of 21st century life? Do you wake up in the middle of the night and find yourself not quite able to doze back off at 3 a.m? I'm here to help. My name is Dave, and I'm your narrator. Here to help you into a restful night. Sleepy Time Tales is intended to be used as a distraction to what keeps you awake at night. Or maybe sometimes background noise or simply company. That's why I make the episodes quite long. So that I'm here for you, without any pressure of the end coming. Now, as far as I know, there are a couple of different ways to engage with the show. The primary idea is that it gives you something to focus on. A story or an event that lets you keep your mind on a specific point. to stop it from spinning out into stress and anxieties. To focus just enough not to resist the embrace of a night's sleep when it comes for you. Or maybe you just need some kind of background noise. There's people that like white noise, or the sound of the ocean, or the wind in the trees, or the sound of rain. Or maybe some people just need a boring dude droning on in the background. What counts though is you don't try to force the sleep. Just keep a light mental grip on the thread of the story as I'm telling it to you, and allow the need for sleep to come for you. Now obviously I'm hoping that you're asleep before I get to the end of the episode. But don't feel pressurized. This may not work on the first night. It might take a couple of nights for you to get used to listening to my voice. Maybe my accent is strange to you. Maybe one episode just isn't long enough. Or maybe your problem isn't so much going to sleep. Maybe you find yourself lying awake or waking up in the middle of the night. What I recommend, because it's what works for me, is to let the podcast run all night. Download a whole bunch of episodes, put them in a playlist, and then let them go. That way, if you find yourself awake at 3 a.m, you can just pop your earbuds back in if they've fallen out and allow yourself to go straight back to sleep again. Sometimes I even do the same thing if I wake up before my alarm goes off. Sometimes I wake up as little as 60 minutes or even as little as 30 minutes before my alarm. And I do the same thing. Pop the earbuds back in, go straight back to sleep again. And you may wonder, Dave, what's the point? What good is an extra 60 minutes or 30 minutes of sleep to me? And I got to tell you, I don't know what it is. But there is something about allowing yourself complete relaxation right before the alarm that's satisfying on a whole new deep level. It is very important though that you try to relax. If you're new to the show and prone to late nights lying staring at the ceiling, this may seem strange to you. So give it a chance. Because I'm here to work with you. To create a safe space. A cocoon in which you can curl up and allow nature to take its course. So if you're still with me, thank you for staying. If you're already asleep, we'll chat again soon. And of course, you aren't hearing me, except maybe in a dream. Our Mutual Friend by Charles Dickens. Book the First, The Cup and the Lip. Chapter 1, On the Lookout. In these times of ours, concerning the exact year, there is no need to be precise. A boat of dirty and disreputable appearance, with two figures in it, floated on the Thames, between Southwark Bridge, which is of iron, and London Bridge, which is of stone, as an autumn evening was closing in. The figures in this boat were those of a strong man, with ragged, grizzled hair and a sun-browned face, and a dark girl of 19 or 20, sufficiently like him to be recognizable as his daughter. The girl rowed, pulling a pair of sculls very easily. The man, with the rudder line slack in his hands, and his hands loose in his waistband, kept an eager lookout. He had no net, hook or line, and he could not be a fisherman. His boat had no cushion for a sitter, no paint, no inscription, no appliance beyond a rusty boat hook and a coil of rope. And he could not be a waterman. His boat was too crazy and too small to take in cargo for delivery. And he could not be a lighterman or river carrier. There was no clue to what he looked for. But he looked for something, with the most intent and searching gaze. The tide, which had turned an hour before, was running down, and his eyes watched every little race and eddy in its broad sweep, as the boat made light headway against it, or drove stern foremost before it, according as he directed his daughter by movement of his head. She watched his face as earnestly as he watched the river. But in the intensity of her look, there was a touch of dread or horror. Ella, to the bottom of the river rather than the surface, by reason of the slime and ooze with which it was covered, and its sodden state. This boat, and the two figures in it, obviously were doing something that they often did, and were seeking what they often sought. Half savage as the man showed, with no covering on his matted head, with his brown arms bared to between the elbow and the shoulder, and the loose knot of a looser kerchief lying low on his bare breast, in a wilderness of beard and whisker, with such dress as he wore seeming to be made out of the mud that begrimed his boat. Still, there was a businesslike usage in his steady gaze. So with every lithe action of the girl, and with every turn of her wrist, perhaps most of all with her look of dread or horror, there were things of usage. Keep her out, Lizzie. Tide runs strong here. Keep her well afore the sweep of it. Trusting to the girl's skill, and making no use of the rudder, he eyed the coming tide with an absorbed attention. So the girl eyed him. But it happened now that a slant of light from the setting sun glanced into the bottom of the boat, and touching a rotten stain there which bore some semblance to the outline of a muffled human form, coloured it as though with diluted blood. This caught the girl's eye and she shivered. "What ails you?" said the man, immediately aware of it, though so intent on the advancing waters. "I see nothing afloat." The red light was gone, the shadow was gone, and his gaze, which had come back to the boat for a moment, travelled away again. Wheresoever the strong tide met with an impediment, his gaze paused for an instant. At every mooring chain and rope, at every stationary boat or barge that split the current into a broad arrowhead, at the offsets from the piers of Southwark Bridge, at the paddles of the river steamboats as they beat the filthy water, at the floating logs of timber lashed together lying off certain wharves, his shining eyes darted a hungry look. After a darkening hour or so, suddenly the rudder lines tightened in his hold, and he steered hard towards the Surrey shore. Always watching his face, the girl instantly answered to the action in her sculling. Presently the boat swung around, quivered as from a sudden jerk, and the upper half of the man was stretched out over the stern. The girl pulled the hood of a cloak she wore, over her head and over her face, and looking backwards so that the front folds of this hood would turn down the river, kept the boat in that direction, going before the tide. Until now, the boat had barely held her own, and had hovered about one spot. But now the banks changed swiftly, and the deepening shadows and the kindling lights of London Bridge were passed, and the tiers of shipping lay on either hand. It was not until now that the upper half of the man came back into the boat. His arms were wet and dirty, and he washed them over the side. In his right hand he held something, and he washed that in the river too. It was money. He chinked it once, and he blew upon it once, and he spat upon it once, for luck, he hoarsely said, before he put it in his pocket. "Lizzie." The girl turned her face towards him with a start and rowed in silence. Her face was very pale. He was a hook-nosed man, and with that and his bright eyes and his ruffled head, bore certain likeness to a roused bird of prey. "Take that thing off your face." She put it back. "Here, and give me a hold of the skulls. I'll take the rest of the spell." "No, no, father, no, I can't indeed. Father, I cannot sit so near it." He was moving towards her to change places, but a terrified expostulation stopped him and he resumed his seat. "What hurt can it do you?" "None. None, but I cannot bear it." "It is my belief you hate the sight of the very river." I do not like it, father." "As if it wasn't your living. As if it wasn't meat and drink to you." At these latter words the girl shivered again, and for a moment paused in her rowing, seeming to turn deadly faint. It escaped his attention, for he was glancing over the stern at something the boat had in tow. "How can you be so thankless to your best friend, Lizzie? The very fire that warmed you when you were a baby was picked out of the river alongside the coal barges. The very basket that you slept in, the tide washed ashore. The very rockers that I put it upon to make a cradle of it, I cut out of a piece of wood that drifted from some ship or another." Lizzie took her right hand from the skull it held and touched her lips with it, and for a moment held it out lovingly towards him. Then, without speaking, she resumed her rowing, as another boat of similar appearance, though in rather better trim, came out from a dark place and dropped softly alongside. "In luck again, gaffer," said a man with a squinting leer, "who sculled her and who was alone. I knowed you was in luck again by your wake as you come down." "Ah," replied the other dryly, "so you're out, are you?" "Yes, pardner." There was now a tender yellow moonlight on the river, and the newcomer, keeping half his boat's length astern of the other boat, looked hard at its track. "I says to myself," he went on, "directly you hove in view, yonder's gaffer and in luck again, but George if he ain't. Skull it is, partner, don't fret yourself, I didn't touch him." This was an answer to a quick impatient movement on the part of Gaffer, the speaker at the same time unshipping his skull on that side and laying his hand on the gunwale of Gaffer's boat and holding to it. "He said touches enough not to want no more as well I can make him out, Gaffer. Been a knocking about with a pretty many tides, ain't he, partner? Such is my out of luck ways, you see. He must have passed me when he went up last time, for I was on the lookout below bridge here. I almost think you like the vultures, partner, and sent him out." He spoke in a dropped voice and with more than one glance at Lizzie, who had pulled on her hood again. Both men then looked with a weird, unholy interest in the wake of Gaffer's boat. "Easy does it betwixt us. Shall I take him aboard, partner?" "No," said the other, in so surly a tone that the man, after a blank stare, acknowledged it with a retort. "Aren't been eating nothing as disagreed with you, have you, partner?" "Why, yes, I have," said Gaffer. "I've been swallowing too much of that word, partner. I'm no partner of yours." "Since when was you no partner of mine, Gaffer Hexham, Esquire?" "Since you was accused of robbing a man." "Accused of robbing a live man," said Gaffer, with great indignation. And what if I'd been accused of robbing a dead man, Gaffer? You couldn't do it. Couldn't you, Gaffer? No. Has a dead man any use for money? Is it possible for a dead man to have money? What world does a dead man belong to? T'other world. What world does money belong to? This world. How can money be a corpse's? Can a corpse own it, want it, spend it, claim it, miss it? Don't try to go confounding the rights and wrongs of things in that way. But it's worthy of the sneaking spirit that robs a live man. I'll tell you what it is. No, you won't. I'll tell you what it is. You got off with a short time of it for putting your hand in the pocket of a sailor, a live sailor. Make the most of it and think yourself lucky, but don't think after that to come over me with your partners. We have worked together in time past, but we work together no more in time present, nor yet future. Let go, cast off. Gaffer, if you think to get rid of me this way, if I don't get rid of you this way, I'll try another, and chop you over the fingers with the stretcher, or take a pick at your head with the bogus hook. Cast off. Pull you, Lizzie, pull home, since you won't let your father pull. Lizzie shot ahead, and the other boat fell astern. Lizzie's father, composing himself into the easy attitude of one who had asserted the high moralities, and taken an unassailable position, slowly lighted a pipe and smoked, and took a survey of what he had in tow. What he had in tow lunged itself at him sometimes in an awful manner, when the boat was checked, and sometimes seemed to try to wrench itself away, though for the most part it followed submissively. A neophyte might have fancied that the ripples passing over it were dreadfully like faint changes of expression on a sightless face. But Gaffer was no neophyte, and had no fancies. Chapter 2. The Man from Somewhere. Mr. and Mrs. Veneering were brand new people in a brand new house, in a brand new quarter of London. Everything about the Veneerings was spick and span new. All their furniture was new, all their friends were new, all their servants were new. Their plate was new, their carriage was new, their harness was new. Their horses were new, their pictures were new. They themselves were new. They were as newly married as was lawfully compatible with their having a brand new baby. And if they had set up a great-grandfather, he would have come home in matting from the Pantechnicon, without a scratch upon him, French polished to the crown of his head. For in the Veneering establishment, from the hall chairs with the new coat of arms, to the grand pianoforte with the new action, and upstairs again to the new fire escape, all things were in a state of high varnish and polish. And what was observable in the furniture was observable in the Veneerings. The surface smelt a little too much of the workshop, and was a trifle sticky. There was an innocent piece of dinner furniture that went upon easy casters, and was kept over a livery stable yard in Duke Street, St. James, when not in use, to whom the Veneerings were a source of blind confusion. The name of this article was Twemlow. Being first cousin to Lord Snigsworth, he was in frequent requisition, and at many houses might be said to represent the dining table in its normal state. Mr. and Mrs. Veneering, for example, arranged a dinner, habitually started with Twemlow, and then put leaves in him, or added guests to him. Sometimes the table consisted of Twemlow and a half dozen leaves. Sometimes of Twemlow and a dozen leaves. Sometimes Twemlow was pulled out to his utmost extent of 20 leaves. Mr. and Mrs. Veneering, on occasions of ceremony, faced each other in the center of the board, and thus the parallel still held. For it always happened that the more Twemlow was pulled out, the further he found himself from the center, and nearer to the sideboard at one end of the room, or the window curtains at the other. But it was not this which steeped the feeble soul of Twemlow in confusion. This he was used to and could take soundings of. The abyss to which he could find no bottom, and from which he stared forth the engrossing and ever-swelling difficulty of his life, was the insoluble question whether he was Veneering's oldest friend or newest friend. To the excogitation of this problem, the harmless gentleman had devoted many anxious hours, both in his lodgings over the livery stable yard and in the cold gloom, favourable to meditation, of St. James's Square. Thus, Twemlow had first known Veneering at his club, where Veneering knew then nobody but the man who had made them known to one another, who seemed to be the most intimate friend he had in the world, and whom he had known 2 days. The bond of union between their souls, the nefarious conduct of the committee respecting the cookery of a fillet of veal, having been accidentally cemented at that date. Immediately upon this, Twemlow received an invitation to dine with Veneering, and dined, the man being of the party. Immediately upon that, Twemlow received an invitation to dine with the man, and dined, Veneering being a man of the party. At the men's were a member, an engineer, a payer off of the national debt, a poem on Shakespeare, a grievance, and a public office, who all seemed to be utter strangers to Veneering. And yet immediately after that, Twemlow received an invitation to dine at Veneering's, expressly to meet the member, the engineer, the payer off of the national debt, the poem on Shakespeare, the grievance, and the public office. And dining discovered that all of them were the most intimate friends Veneering had in the world, and that the wives of all of them, who were all there, were the objects of Mrs. Veneering's most devoted affection and tender confidence. Thus it came about that Mr. Twemlow had said to himself in his lodgings, with his hand on his forehead, "I must not think of this. This is enough to soften any man's brain." And yet was always thinking of it, and could never form a conclusion. This evening the Veneerings gave a banquet. 11 leaves in the Twemlow, 14 in company all told. 4 pigeon-breasted retainers in plain clothes stand in line in the hall. A 5th retainer, proceeding up the staircase with a mournful air, as who should say, "Here is another wretched creature come to dinner, such as life," announces, "Mr. Twemlow." Mrs. Veneering welcomes her sweet Mr. Twemlow. Mr. Veneering welcomes his dear Twemlow. Mrs. Veneering does not expect that Mr. Twemlow can in nature care much for such insipid things as babies. But so old a friend must please to look at baby. "Ah, you will know the friend of your family better, Tootleums," says Mr. Veneering, nodding emotionally at that new article, "when you begin to take notice." He then begs to make his dear Twemlow known to his 2 friends. Mr. Boots and Mr. Brewer, and clearly has no distinct idea which is which. But now a fearful circumstance occurs. Mr. and Mrs. Podsnap. "My dear," says Mr. Veneering to Mrs. Veneering, with an air of much friendly interest, while the door stands open, "the Podsnaps." A too smiling large man, with a fatal freshness on him, appearing with his wife, instantly deserts his wife and darts at Twemlow with, "How do you do? So glad to know you. Charming house you have here. I hope we are not late. So glad of the opportunity, I'm sure. When the first shock fell upon him, Twemlow twice skipped back in his neat little shoes and his neat little silk stockings of a bygone fashion, as if impelled to leap over a sofa behind him. But the large man closed with him and proved too strong. "Let me," says the large man, trying to attract the attention of his wife in the distance, "have the pleasure of presenting Mrs. Podsnap to her host." "She will be." In his fatal freshness, he seems to find so perpetual verdure and eternal youth in the phrase. "She'll be so glad of the opportunity, I am sure." In the meantime, Mrs. Podsnap, unable to originate a mistake on her own account, because Mrs. Veneering is the only other lady here, does her best in the way of handsomely supporting her husband's, by looking towards Mr. Twemlow with a plaintive countenance, and remarking to Mrs. Veneering in a feeling manner, firstly, that she fears he has been rather bilious of late, and secondly, that the baby is already very like him. It is questionable whether any man quite relishes being mistaken for another man. But Mr. Veneering, having this very evening set up the shirt front of the young Antinous in a new worked cambric just come home, is not at all complimented for being supposed to be Twemlow, who is dry and weazen and some 30 years older. Mrs. Veneering equally resents the imputation of being the wife of Twemlow. As to Twemlow, he is so sensible of being a much better bred man than Veneering, that he considers the large man an offensive ass. In this complicated dilemma, Mr. Veneering approaches the large man with extended hand, and smilingly assures the incorrigible personage that he is delighted to see him, who in his fatal freshness instantly replies, "Thank you. I am ashamed to say that I cannot at this moment recall where we met. But I'm so glad of this opportunity, I am sure." Then pouncing upon Twemlow, who holds back with all his feeble might, he is hailing him off to present him as Veneering to Mrs. Podsnap, when the arrival of more guests unravels the mistake. Whereupon, having re-shaken hands with Veneering as Veneering, he reshakes hands with Twemlow as Twemlow, and winds it all up, to his own perfect satisfaction, by saying to the last named, "Ridiculous opportunity, but so glad of it, I'm sure." Now Twemlow, having undergone this terrific experience, having likewise noted the fusion of boots and brewer and brewer and boots, and having further observed that of the remaining 7 guests, 4 discreet characters enter with wandering eyes, and wholly decline to commit themselves as to which is Veneering, until Veneering has them in his grasp. Twemlow, having profited by these studies, finds his brain wholesomely hardening as he approaches the conclusion that he really is Veneering's oldest friend, when his brain softens again and all is lost. Through his eyes, encountering Veneering and the large man linked together as twin brothers in the back drawing room near the conservatory door, and through his ears informing him in the tones of Mrs. Veneering that the same man is to be baby's godfather. "Dinner is on the table." Thus the melancholy retainer, as who should say, "Come down and be poisoned, ye unhappy children of men." Twemlow, having no lady assigned him, goes down in the rear, with his hand to his forehead. Boots and Brewer, thinking him indisposed, whisper, "Man faint, had no lunch." But he is only stunned by the unvanquishable difficulty of his existence. Revived by soup, Twemlow discourses mildly of the court circular with boots and brewer. Is it appealing to, at the fish stage of the banquet? By veneering on the disputed question whether his cousin Lord Snigsworth is in or out of town. Gives it that his cousin is out of town. At Snigsworthy Park, Veneering inquires. At Snigsworthy, Twemlow rejoins. Boots and Brewer regard this as a man to be cultivated, and Veneering is clear that he's a remunerative article. Meantime, the retainer goes round, like a gloomy analytical chemist, always seeming to say, after Shabless, sir, you wouldn't if you knew what it's made of. The great-looking glass above the sideboard reflects the table and the company, reflects the new Veneering crest in gold and eke and silver, frosted and also thawed, a camel of all work. The Herald's College found out a crusading ancestor for Veneering who bore a camel on his shield, or might have done it if he had thought of it. And a caravan of camels take charge of the fruits and flowers and candles, and kneel down to be loaded with the salt. Reflects Veneering, 40, wavy-haired, dark, tending to corpulence, sly, mysterious, filmy, a kind of sufficiently well-looking veiled prophet, not prophesying. Reflects Mrs. Veneering, fair, aquiline-nosed, and fingered. Not so much light hair as she might have. Gorgeous in raiment and jewels. Enthusiastic, preparatory, conscious that a corner of her husband's veil is over herself. Reflects Podsnap, prosperously feeding. Two little light wiry wings, one on either side of his else bald head. Looking as like his hairbrushes as his hair. Dissolving view of red beads on his forehead. Large allowance of crumpled shirt collar up behind. Reflects Mrs. Podsnap. Fine woman for Professor Owen. Quantity of bone, neck and nostrils like a rocking horse. Hard features. Majestic headdress in which Podsnap has hung golden offerings. Reflects Twemlow. Grey, dry, polite, susceptible to east wind. First gentleman in Europe collar and cravat, cheeks drawn in as if he had made a great effort to retire himself some years ago, and had got so far and had never got any further. Reflects mature young lady, raven locks and complexion that lights up well when well powdered, as it is, carrying on considerably in the captivation of mature young gentlemen. With too much nose in his face and too much ginger in his whiskers. Too much torso in his waistcoat. Too much sparkle in his studs. His eyes, his buttons, his talk, and his teeth. Reflects charming old Lady Tippins on Veneering's right, with an immense, obtuse, drab, oblong face, like a face in a tablespoon, and a dyed long walk up the top of her head. As a convenient public approach to the bunch of false hair behind. Pleased to patronize Mrs. Veneering opposite, who is pleased to be patronized. Reflects a certain Mortimer, another of Veneering's oldest friends, who never was in the house before, and appears not to want to come again. Who sits disconsolate on Mrs. Veneering's left, and who was inveigled by Lady Tippins, a friend of his boyhood, to come to these peoples and talk, and who won't talk. Reflects Eugene, friend of Mortimer, buried alive in the back of his chair, behind a shoulder with a powder epaulette on it, of the mature young lady, and gloomily resorting to the champagne chalice whenever proffered by the analytical chemist. Lastly, the looking glass reflects Boots and Brewer, and two other stuffed buffers interposed between the rest of the company and possible accidents. The Veneering dinners are excellent dinners, or new people wouldn't come, and all goes well. Notably, Lady Tippins has made a series of experiments on her digestive functions, so extremely complicated and daring that if they could be published with the results, it might benefit the human race. Having taken in provisions from all parts of the world, this hardy old cruiser has last touched at the North Pole, when, as the ice plates are being removed, the following words fall from her. I assure you, my dear Verneering. Poor Twemlow's hand approaches his forehead, for it would seem now that Lady Tippins is going to be the oldest friend. I assure you, dear Verneering, that it is the oddest affair. Like the advertising people. I don't ask you to trust me without offering a respectable reference. Mortimer here is my reference and knows all about it. Mortimer raises his drooping eyelids and slightly opens his mouth. But a faint smile, expressive of what's the use, passes over his face, and he drops his eyelids and shuts his mouth. Now, Mortimer, says Lady Tippins, wrapping the sticks of her closed green fan upon the knuckles of her left hand, which is particularly rich in knuckles. I insist upon your telling all that is to be told about the man from Jamaica. Give you my honour, I never heard of any man from Jamaica, except the man who was a brother, replies Mortimer. Tobago, then. Nor yet from Tobago. Except, Eugene strikes in, so unexpectedly that the mature young lady, who has forgotten all about him, with a start takes the epaulette out of his way. Except our friend who long lived on rice pudding and isinglass, still at length to his something or other. His physician said something else. And a leg of mutton somehow ended in Dago. A reviving impression goes round the table that Eugene is coming out. An unfulfilled impression, for he goes in again. Now, my dear Mrs. Veneering, quoth Lady Tippins, I appeal to you whether this is not the basest conduct ever known in this world. I carry my lovers about, two or three at a time, on condition that they are very obedient and devoted. And here is my oldest lover in chief, the head of all my slaves, throwing off his allegiance before company. And here is another of my lovers, a rough Kaimon at present, certainly, but of whom I had most hopeful expectations as to his turning out well in course of time, pretending that he can't remember his nursery rhymes, on purpose to annoy me, for he knows how I dote upon them. A grisly little fiction concerning her lovers is Lady Tippins's point. She is always attended by a lover or two, and she keeps a little list of her lovers, and she is always booking a new lover or striking out an old lover, or putting a new lover in her black list, or promoting a lover to her blue list, or adding up her lovers or otherwise posting her book. Mrs. Veneering is charmed by the humour, and so is Veneering. Perhaps it is enhanced by certain yellow play in Lady Tippins's throat, like the legs of scratching poultry. I banish the false wretch from this moment, and I strike him out of my Cupidon, my name for my ledger, my dear, this very night. But I am resolved to have the account of the man from somewhere, and I beg you to elicit it for me, my love, to Mrs. Veneering, as I have lost my influence. Oh, you perjured man, this to Mortimer, with a rattle of her fan. And on that interesting note, I think I'm going to call it a night. You can, as always, pick up where we've left off on Project Gutenberg at the link in the show notes. Thanks again for joining me on this episode of Sleepy Time Tales, the podcast designed around a bedtime story to help you to get a restful night. New episodes will be released every Sunday night to give you something fresh to help you rest in a new week. But make sure to subscribe in whatever service you use so that you get your new episodes whenever they come out. A reminder that the music for tonight is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiku. Check out more of their work on their website, which you'll find linked in the show notes. Good night and sweet dreams.